The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
There's a value of perfection that is possible for the divine, and specifically I say possible, God can choose to express this becoming perfect, this dynamic perfection. And when God chooses to express this becoming perfect, then it becomes manifest through creating a world, and creating in this world an imperfect being who yearns to become more perfect. And God, so to speak, invests an aspect of Himself, so to speak, the neshama, the soul, in this character, and in so doing partakes in the expression of the dynamic perfection. And our goal is to grow. Nobody in the Torah is perfect, and nowhere does it say in Torah that anybody's expecting you to be perfect, as it says in the Talmud, that the Torah wasn't given to angels. Alright? In fact, it also says in the Talmud, Baratzi Yetzihara, Barati Torah Tavlin. I created a Yetzihara, and I created the antidote, which is the Torah. So therefore the Torah relates to, acknowledges, that I have a lot of different energies, a lot of conflicting energies, and the Torah relates to that. Alright? And with those conflicting energies, and the combustion that happens within myself, depending on what I do, I can either explode, or if I know how to direct it, those energies can propel me forward. Alright? And that's what we're here to be doing. We're here to be growing. And the Zohar says that everyone is probably familiar with the fact that we have a Yetzer Hara, we have an evil inclination, and then we have a Yetzer Tov, we have a good inclination. So the Zohar says that the good inclination is a child. It's referred to metaphorically as a Nal, a child. But the evil inclination is referred to metaphorically as an old, foolish king. Now what's the relation between an old, foolish king? Why would the Yetzer Hara be called an old, foolish king? And why would the Yetzer Tov, the good inclination, why would that be called a child, a Nar? What's the difference between a Nar, a child, and an old, foolish king?
A child is always growing, whereas sometimes when we get older, we get set in our ways and we refuse to change or grow.
So in terms of this idea, I think that's the appropriate way of interpreting that, which is the child, in fact, the word for child used is Nar. Nun ayin reish. And nar comes from the word linna'er. Linna'er means to shake up. Shake something up. And therefore, nar is an appropriate word. Nar is an appropriate word for the child because the child is very agitated. He's always moving. He needs to move. He needs to grow. Children love adventure. Okay? You'll ask your child, you might live 5 minutes away from the school, and your kid comes home an hour and a half later after school, and you say, "Where were you?" He says, "I was just walking home." But we live 10 minutes away. He says, "I don't know. I was just walking home." He says, "Well, how long could it take you to get here? I mean, what did you do?" He says, "Well, you remember that backyard with the sign that says, beware of vicious dog?" So we thought it would be really interesting if we climbed over the fence and we kind of move across the yard. "Hi, Poochie, hi, Poochie, hi, Poochie." And then, remember that antenna? Well, we climbed up that antenna and jumped over to the other roof. And you say, "Well, why can't you just come home? Like, there's a very straight, easy path." But children love adventure. Okay? Their excitement isn't simply getting there. Okay, their excitement is the getting there itself. It's the process on the way. And we lose that. We lose that beauty of adventure. We lose the joy of the journey. But children They love the journey. It's kind of hard to get them to even get to where you want to go because they're looking around and they're walking like this and they're looking, you know, and that's the way they are, and that's very beautiful. That's the good inclination. The good inclination loves to grow. The good inclination loves adventure. The good inclination loves challenge. See, a child, for him, why eat spaghetti with a fork if I could do it with a straw? Now that would be interesting, you know? Just suck each one of them up. That's an interesting thing. They like to make life difficult. Not because it's a difficulty that burdens them, but because it's an adventure, it's a challenge, it's exciting. And so life is a challenge. And if you're ready to acknowledge that it's a challenge, and see it as the challenge of any good game, where the challenge itself is what makes it fun, so then life can be truly a lot of fun. And so this is the dynamic of our lives. We are not truly human beings. We're actually human becomings. And that's our role in the universe. That's our service to God. Who you are is God's gift to you. Who you become is your gift to God. All right. What I want to do today is I want to develop what I would call the structure of the becoming. All right? The structure of the becoming. And so let's think about a becoming. Let's say I'm watching somebody painting. So that's a certain becoming, right? Right. So if I was to somehow conceptually give that a structure, what would you say? I mean, how would you structure that? Okay, you see somebody painting, but of course there's a segment, there's a movement here, there's a structure. All right, there are layers to it. If I could somehow take it and cut it and give a cross section of this, how would you view this? What would be the underlying current? What would be the very fastest? What would be moving what? Do you follow this? You don't follow this. So I'll give you an example. I'll start it off. All right? If I'm watching a certain becoming, someone's painting, then the first thing that's drawing the process along is their will. Okay? Their will. They want to do something. Okay? And that will continues to drive the entire process through. Everything you do must take will. For me to lift up my hand must take will. For you to sit there in your chair must take will. For you to write your notes must take will. Will is driving the process through. Okay? But it takes much more than will, okay, to create a process. What's the next layer? What does will then give birth to, so to speak? You want. What?
Motivation.
Well, that's your will. You're motivated. There's something moving you.
Action.
Well, that's the ends. So the last part of this whole thing is the particular activity. That's the last part of this whole cross-section. But there's a tremendous amount in between. But in between, from the will to the particular activity, there are layers and layers and layers of process. So, after the will, you need to have a goal. Alright? This painter has a goal. Okay? They have a certain image, a certain vision. Alright? They want to paint. They want. What do they want? They want to express love. That's their goal. But I want to express love. Well, how do I want to express love? Okay? By painting a picture of a mother holding her child. So therefore, in this process, there's actually a plan. There's a will, there's a goal, and then there's a plan. And then the artist abides by certain rules of methodology. Okay? He has a method. And then, only then, the last layer of this process is the particular activity itself. Okay? But while I'm doing this, there are layers of aspects which is driving the process through. So if I were to draw this, I would have the will that is just driving, it's an undercurrent that's moving the whole process. The will gives birth to a goal and a plan. And the goal and the plan determine the appropriate method. You have to have the right method. If you have the wrong method, it's not going to fulfill the plan or the goal. And so therefore there's the method, and then there's the particular activity. Each aspect, so to speak, engarbs itself within the other aspect as it drives the whole process through. Okay? That's our life. That's the structure of this becoming. That's the structure of our lives. Okay? That's the structure of our lives. Now, according to Kabbalah, what's hinted here is the crown of the yud itself, the hay, the vav, and the hay. That's what's suggested in that name of God. There's certain structure to reality. All of reality has a will, a goal, a plan, a method, or we could call it principles of organization. And then the particular activity. Alright? The particular activity. I had a woman who did our program who was very involved with business planning. She's hired by businesses to consult in terms of strategy planning. So when she heard this, she said, "This is what I learned in business school." Well, I got it from Kabbalah. So it's quite amazing. But this is the structure of everything. All effective living must have a structure. Okay? Must have a structure in your life. You have to get in touch with your will. Okay? Which is the most powerful part of yourself. If you lose your will, then everything falls apart because it's the root energy. It's the driving current. Okay? And so, you have to get in touch with your will. But then again, I want something. A lot of people want, but they don't know what they want. So you have to come up with, well, what do you want out of life? What is your goal? You know, what is your goal? Happiness, right? Freedom. I mean, what is your goal? And then once you've got your goal, that certainly won't be enough, because then you have to have a much more particular image of that goal. A person's goal might be security. Okay, but what is a particular formula of security? One person will say it's a relationship. Another person will say it's a car. Another person will say it's a teddy bear. Hopefully that person's 5 years old. But anyways, but that would be the plan. That would be the plan, that you have a particular formula that reflects that goal, that fulfills your will. But once you have that goal and your plan, then you need principles. Okay? You need certain guidelines. Alright? You need rules. Alright? A certain method. What method? Certain methods will fulfill this plan, and certain methods will not fulfill this plan. Okay? It's like, for instance, a supervisor in a factory. Okay, so his job is to get the job done. Now he has to guide these workers. So you could have one worker that the best approach with him is to be really tough and, "Hey, get it moving, what's with you?" And another worker, it doesn't work that way. Okay? With this person, you have to guide this person in another way, by being sweet or nice. In other words, there's certain principles that you apply in getting the job done. And so there are principles of organization. And all this, the will, the goal, the plan, and the method must guide the particular activity. Alright? And so what would be the path to genuine happiness, ultimate growth? How does one plug into the tremendous energy of will? Well, you have to make sure that your activity is coordinated and synchronized with your principles. You see, there are times where we do things which are not aligned with our inner principles. Okay? And thereby we feel very fragmented. We lose a lot of energy. We lose a lot of direction. We become very frustrated. Because what we're doing is in no way coordinated with our principles. Okay? With our principles. Okay? So in Judaism, there are 6 guiding principles to life. Okay? And that's, I mean, according to this, how this would be expressed in Kabbalistic terminology. So the will is called crown, keter. The goal is called wisdom, or more properly, chachma. The plan is called understanding, which is called bina. And then you have six attributes over here, which is kindness, strength, truth, dominance, and submission. That's only five. Where's less on peace?
What?
Peace. These are six principles of life that must guide your life. The principle of kindness. Strength, by the way, is also judgment, justice. Let's call it justice. Kindness, justice, truth, which harmonizes those two. And in that situation, then you must decide how much to dominate, to control, how much to let go, and then that has to be brought together in a peaceful format. Okay, the way it's drawn, right is kindness, left is justice, middle is truth, right is dominance, left is submission, and middle is peace. And this is the structure of our principles of life that should guide us. Okay? These are the principles that should guide us. It's two opposite forces, kindness and justice, the right and the left, and then a harmonizing force, which is the truth. Okay? The truth. And then, once I decide, you know, then there has to be a decision in terms of, well, how much to control, dominance, which is called netzach, and how much to let go, okay, which is called hope. And then that has to be harmonized. There has to be a factor, there has to be a principle that is able to harmonize that. And that structure then directs and guides my particular activity. And so what does it take to be happy? You're probably wondering. All right? That my particular activity is coordinated with my principles. Okay? My principles. If I have adopted, or if I innately feel that one of the fundamental principles of life is kindness, okay, and then I do something cruel, alright, then I'm betraying myself, and I am fragmenting myself, alright, and I'm ultimately destroying myself, alright. If, in fact, what's going on over here is the gestalt, the principle that should be guiding my behavior in this situation should be justice, but I go ahead and behave in a different way, well then I'm fragmenting myself. I will not be happy. Alright? And so therefore, the principles should be guiding and directing my activity. My activity should be conforming appropriately and synchronizing appropriately to my principles. But that's not enough. Because my principles have to be coordinated with my plan. In other words, if my principles are inappropriate to what I'm really trying to accomplish, all right? If, in fact, justice or being judgmental is not going to be a principle that will guide me and lead me to the warm kind of relationship I'm trying to achieve in this moment, well, then that wouldn't work. That would be bad. Do you follow that? In other words, the principles themselves must be in accordance, proper accordance to the plan. And the plan, of course, has to truly reflect my goals. Because if they don't reflect my goals, right, so then once again I'm fragmented. And then, of course, all this has to fulfill my will. Alright? And if you can do that, if your particular activity is coordinated and synchronized with your principles, and your principles are in sync and jive with your plan, which reflects your goal, which fulfills your will, you win the game of life. Okay? You win the game of life. But you see, it's not over yet. Why? Because maybe within yourself you are integrated, because that's the name of the game, integration. But what if your individual life is not in coordination with the cosmic life? Or, let's start slower. Your individual life is not coordinated with the community. In other words, maybe this is working for you as an individual. You know, your behavior is, in fact, completely coordinated with your principles. Your principle is, thou shalt murder. And you do murder. And you feel real good about that, because in fact you are being true to yourself. right? And your goal is to control the world. And so, in fact, you are doing things like that. But in a communal sense, your particular system is not in harmony with the communal principles of life. Okay? Not in harmony with the communal path, the communal plan, the communal goal, the communal will. Okay, well, maybe you are in sync with your community. Your community is really happy. Because my community's principles is that the first rule is thou shalt have pleasure and fun and do what thou shalt want. And we, in fact, go ahead and do that. And maybe our community is maybe feeling real good about itself. But my community is out of sync with the world. Okay? And my world might be happy, but it's out of sync with the universal reality, God. In other words, my goal is that my principles are coordinated with the divine principles, with the ultimate principles, okay, with the universal principles. That my behavior is coordinated and synchronized with the movement of life, okay, with the movement of life. In other words, the example I often give is like this. Life is a big symphony orchestra, okay? A symphony. The music is written, alright? The key signature is set. And each and every one of us has our own particular instrument. You're a guitar player, you're a trumpet player, you're a tuba player, you're a drum player, and then there's that conductor. Okay, in our metaphor over here, the conductor and the composer is the one and only Hashem, God. But each and every one of us has been given this tremendous opportunity to facilitate the expression and the manifestation of this music. Okay, now there's a very beautiful experience that one can feel. I mean, has anybody here been in a band? Right? Been in a band? Or if you don't have to do it in a musical way, you've been in a sports team. Okay, there's a certain flow and movement that is just so perfectly synchronized and coordinated. Everybody's moving just exactly, and so when you start playing the music, so it's a little and they're kind of tuning up. You know, you walk into and that is when we're children. We're just tuning up. Okay, and so things, you walk into a kindergarten, they're all over the place. Okay, well that's okay. Well, we're just tuning up, but then there gets to a point where we're playing the music and we become perfectly synchronized with each other, perfectly interfaced with the mind and the will and the soul of the conductor. It's an absolutely incredible experience. Okay? Absolutely incredible experience. When each and every one of us is playing our part just right and we understand how each one of our parts are so connected with each other. We're following the principles of the music. We are playing, we've been practicing for quite some time to really play it properly, and when we play it properly, we're not like a bunch of monkeys that are just mimicking something, but something is coming through us, okay? And we're all part of that. What then happens? We're all coordinated, right? Our particular behavior is coordinated with the principles that govern the music, and these principles are fulfilling exactly the goal of what this music is suggesting and portraying, which is fulfilling the will of this conductor, and we're all part of that. But you know what happens? There's a tremendous joy and a tremendous inner sense of meaning when we're also coordinated and we're also harmonious. But then what happens? Well, all of a sudden we hear this kind of dissonance, you know? And sometimes, you know, what's going on? And, and you have this beautiful orchestra, but a sensitive ear, only a sensitive ear, of course, you know, hears that there's this one violin player whose violin is just a little out of key. Now, the connoisseur will know that that is destroying the entire symphony. Now, you know, who cares? You know, please. But the one who really knows what the music can be and should be, the conductor starts to look around. You know, something's wrong here. Right? It's not simply that individual. But that individual, because they're so out of key, just a little bit out of key, it's actually creating a dissonance for the entire harmonious work. Alright? Very important. Alright? I remember, I was working for this Jewish youth organization, And it was, I just started working there. So the way you impress kids these days is music, you know, rock. Well, you really become very impressive. And I knew that if they knew I was a rabbi, that wouldn't interest them. And the fact that I wore a kippah was already, you know, difficult for them. But if I could play music, you know, so then that would gain respect. So we were doing a convention and they invited this kind of religious rock band. Alright? This religious rock band. And so we decide. I said to him, "Hey, gee, you know, would you mind if I play with the band? Because if I get on stage with, you know, an electric piano, then that will gain a tremendous respect in their eyes, and I'll be hip, and they'll, you know, they'll really like me, and I'll be able to have more impact, you know, in terms of educating them." So, you know, I said, "Yeah, great, that's a great idea." So I said, "Well, let's get together and practice." "Yeah, sure, sure, sure." But what happened in the end is we never got together and practice, and we're driving up to this convention, and they say, "Oh, we'll do it in the car. We'll do it in the car." In the meantime, I play music according by ear. I don't know notes. I don't, like, well, it's in this key, and just keep on at this and a that and a that and a this. And I don't know what, you know. And so I said, "I told you I play by ear." And so I wanted to practice and get a feeling for the songs. "That'll be all right. It'll be all right. It's fine." So we get to the convention, and we're on stage, and they open up the curtains, and people, "Wow, look who's up there. It's Rabbi Aaron. Wow, what's he doing up there with this rock band?" And so... So we started playing this music, okay, this kind of Jewish rock and roll music, you know, like, whatever, it doesn't matter. So we start playing, and I notice that the head of the band is kind of looking around like, "Something's wrong, something's wrong." You know, and I was getting really into it, but I was realizing that I wasn't at all in key, I didn't know what they were doing, and I kind of saw that the guys in the band were kind of looking around like, "Where is this dissonance coming from? Where is the dissonance?" So I realized at a certain point that this is ridiculous. I'm destroying the whole thing. So I turned the piano off, and I played for an hour and a half with my piano off. But then I was even better, because then I just started doing all these really great stuff, and I started playing with my feet and my nose, and you know, people are, "Wow, he's really great, you know, little Richie, you know, little rabbi." And so... So we were doing that, and then they're in the middle of in the concert, the head of the band says, "And I want to introduce all the guys from the band." All right? And so he said, "You know, we got Jack on bass, and, you know, doom, 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 you know, and we got, you know, Joey on the drum, and we got so and so on the trumpet, and we got Rabbi Aaron on the piano." Oop, and I turned on my piano, went, "Ding, ding, ding." And I turned it off. That's all I played for the entire evening. The amazing thing is after the concert, how many people came up to me and told me I sounded like Elton John? "Wow, how can you do that? I mean, who's your favorite? Wow, Stevie Wonder, Elton John." It was a hard decision, you know, but I wasn't playing the all night. What was even more amazing is that the band asked me to be a permanent member. They thought it really added a tremendous amount, and the piano, and it was just unbelievable. Anyways, the point is that you put out a certain dissonance, and you can fake people off, which is much of our lives. We're faking everyone out. We look like we're in it. We're playing the music, but we're not at all playing the music. Okay, we're not at all playing the music. And so we have to be really careful with ourselves that we're not faking off and putting on a good show, because that's easy to put on a good show. But in the end, we'll find ourselves 20, 30, 50, 70, 120, realize I've been putting on a good show the entire lifetime, and I've never served, I've never played anything. Nothing has come through me into this world. Okay, so we hear this guy, and he's a little off key, all right? And then he goes a little off beat, okay? And then he eventually plays a completely different song. Alright? And that's what's called sin. Alright? Sin starts off with being a little off. You're not harmonious with the movement of life. Okay? You're not synchronized with the will of the conductor. Alright? You then begin to go off rhythm. You begin even to start playing a completely different song. And then you come to the absolute ridiculous illusion that really, your personal meaning would be best experienced if you became a soloist. And so you decide that's it. What do I need a conductor for? What do I need this music for? Why do I have to limit myself to this symphony? I'll become the greatest solo tuba player in the world. That's right. Right? I know nobody has ever done it, but that's because they didn't realize they could. I'll do it. I'll become a tuba player. There's no such thing as a tuba player without a band, without working together, without following a certain, you know, and so it goes off, tuba player. That's really the illusion of the ego. The ego tries to convince us that there's nothing that we need to be a part of. There's nothing in our human behavior that needs to coordinate in, with anything beyond ourselves. Okay? And that's really the ego. And that's what we mentioned the other day. That's what a cancerous cell really is. A cancerous cell is a cell that decides that it's self-defined, self-sufficient. It doesn't have to play by the rules of the body. It'll do its own thing. It'll do its own thing. And you got to be so incredibly careful with that. All right? So incredibly careful with that. Doing your own thing. That's really what a sin is in Judaism. I'm off the mark. I'm not in rhythm. Yes, Elsa?
Isn't it more like the ego is the one saying, I'm the tuba player, I don't need the band, and the ego is actually saying, no, no, you need the band, and this is why? Because you have to be a part of society?
No. The ego is saying, I don't need anybody, and the soul is saying, well, I don't want to call it super ego, I just simply call it soul. Well,
what is the
intellect? Well, you know, everybody's got all these different names, and I don't know which one's referring to what anymore. So I'll just call it the soul, which is my essential self, which is derived through and meaningful because of its relationship to the eternal you, okay? My essential I, who's defined by, through, the identification with the eternal you in that relationship. And then there's my ego that feels that it doesn't have to be in a relation with anything, anybody, just with myself, do whatever I want, how I want, where I want. So my good inclination knows.
So is that your ego?
My evil inclination works on ego. Right? There's a lot of good energy in my evil inclination too. But when you take evil inclination to its ultimate extreme, so it creates this hard ego that believes that in and of myself, independent of this band, and independent of this world, independent of the all-encompassing one reality, God, right, I have meaning. I have substance, I have direction, I have value. And that's simply not true. Okay, what's the meaning of meaning? The meaning of meaning is a word in a sentence is a meaningful word. A word outside of a sentence is a meaningless word. Okay, words have no meaning unless they are somehow harmoniously working with the rest of the sentence, which is harmoniously working with the rest of the paragraph, with the chapter, with the book, and is fitting into the very theme of what this whole book is. That's a meaningful word. Okay? If I say, Joe sneezed the ball, alright? Well, certainly one of these words is meaningless, okay? Because sneeze and ball don't seem to make any sense. So either ball is the meaningless word here, or sneeze is the meaningless word here, or maybe it's Joe who's really meaningless and doing such stupid things. But we see that the word must fit its context, and that's the yearning for meaning. How do I fit? What's the role I play? How do I become part of this? All right? How do I achieve harmony with the all-encompassing, all-embracing symphony of life? What's my unique role? But even my unique role in some way, my unique role in some way must interface and be harmonious with everybody else. Okay? With everybody else. Alright. So that's the path of happiness. That my particular activity is synchronized with my principles. All right, my principles with the plan with the goal with my will. But of course, I'm not an island. I'm not a rock. Who said that? Okay? Some Jew, right? I'm not an island. I'm not a rock. But, you know, I must see myself as part of a greater whole, where the whole is part of my personal definition. And I can't just go off and do what I feel like, when I feel like, how I feel like. Because that will not only undermine the symphony, but that will ultimately undermine myself. Okay? Because I'm so much part of the symphony, and the symphony is so much part of me. Okay? That's the goal. That's what it's all about. Alright? So in Aveira in Judaism, we are taught that when a person sins, What they're doing is they're causing the hay of God's name to drop, so to speak, and become disconnected from the rest of the word. Okay? And then, of course, it has no meaning. A letter has no meaning unless it's part of a word. Alright? Unless it's part of a word. Alright? But what are you supposed to do when you do a sin, so to speak? Okay? What you're supposed to do is something called teshuvah. Okay? Teshuvah. So the Ari, Rabbi Isaac Lurie, explains that what that really means is tashuv hey. Return the hay. What's the hay? What are you talking about? It's this hay. I have taken a particular activity, my individual behavior, and I have severed from the principles, the guiding principles of life. Alright? And that's very, very serious. And therefore I have to return that, coordinate myself back to those principles of life, those guiding forces of life. Alright? And if I don't do that, it's as silly as trying to go against gravity. You know? I just don't want anything to do with gravity. And so, I have a particular activity in my life, the particular behavior in my life, if it's severed from the principles of the music of life, well then I, so to speak, cause this hay to drop. And the full name of God is not being revealed. Okay? And I'm part of revealing that name of God, so to speak. When I do teshuvah, when I repent, so I cause this hay to return back to it. Alright? Now generally the Kabbalah says you can only damage the hay of God's name. Alright? But there is a possibility to also in some way affect the vav, the principles of life. How so? Because, Judaism says that when a person does something three times, if a person does a transgression three times, it becomes to them a mitzvah. Right? In their mind, it's now a mitzvah. It's a positive thing to do. I walk into a store, right? And, I see something very attractive, I don't have the money for it, so I say, and I grab it, shove my pocket, run out. Then I feel bad. Because my behavior in some way conflicted with my inner principles. Alright? But I did it anyways. Okay, fine. Well, what can I do? I say to myself, I'm not going to do that again. Alright? Walk into the store, see something else. I will never do it again, but just this one more time. Did it. Shove it in my pocket. Okay? Remember, three times and you're out. Walk into the store again. Oh, I won't do this. I won't do it. It's much difficult to hold yourself back when you get to the second time. Third time you do it. Alright? That's it. After you've done it the third time, the next time you walk into the store, you'll say, you know what, these corporate bums, they deserve it. I'm doing a mitzvah. You know, I'm restoring justice in the world. I come up with all these rationalizations. In other words, I redefine my principles of life. Okay? Once my behavior has become somewhat habitually disconnected from the principles, and that only takes three times, then my next move as I begin to redefine the principles. And then I become really sick where I redefine the goals and I redefine the plan and all of a sudden I'm saying crazy things that are just so non-commonsensical. Right? But now I say, well, what's wrong with this and what's wrong with that? And well, why can't the person just, do this? And why can't, I start asking these why can't, which is only justifying a lifestyle that I'm not willing to work on. You know, I don't want to take the work to get out of this habit. And so I create a theology, a complete world outlook, that will best make me feel good with a lifestyle that I've adopted. And I probably didn't even adopt it. I fell into it. But I don't have the courage or the guts or the strength to work myself out of it. And I've got to be very careful because most people do this. They do not first try to find what's true, what's right, what makes sense, what will bring harmony in the world, what's worked for thousands of years, but rather they start with just themselves and say, oh gee, is this going to fit into my life? Is this going to be easy? Is this going to be difficult? Is this going to be, And in the beginning it will be difficult, okay? But you will come to a point where it will just plug right in to a higher nature, to a higher principle. This is what I've mentioned before. When a child is growing up, so you're trying to toilet train them. From their perspective, you are, in fact, conflicting with their inner principles. Because their inner principles say, you know, you can do it anywhere. You can do it everywhere. You know, just be free and natural. Okay? But as a parent, you're coming down and they're looking at you saying, oh, come on, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with you adults? Don't you know that you can do it in your pants and it's okay? Okay? And so and in that initial stage of development, so you feel like you're really going against my principles, mother and father. You know, of course you can't say that. But there's a very beautiful little toilet training book in Israel. It's called, you know, in Hebrew, a potty is called a seer. Okay? So there's a book, it's a beautiful illustration to teach children how to go to the bathroom, and it's called Sir Hasirim, right? Which is the pot of pots, a little play on Shir Hashirim, which is the Song of Songs. Anyways, there's this little cute thing about this little baby, and you see the picture, you can show this to your kids, because no words, you know, a few words for you to say to your kids, but basically it's a total picture thing, it's very cute. And so the kid looks at it, and you know, the mother brings this beautiful package, and you see a picture of this package with a bow. Wow, this was fantastic. And he opens it up, and there it is. And she goes, wow. So he puts it on his head. No, it's not a hat. So he puts a flower in it. No, mother says, no, it's not a flower pot. And he comes up with all these weird things until she tries to get him to understand that you can't, this is something wholly new. Right, you have to have Zen mind, okay, when you come to potty. You know, the whole new reality is opening up to you. It this goes in there. And his whole process of dealing with understanding that. But in the initial process, it feels unnatural. He might feel somewhat coerced, okay? Of course, the parents have to be very careful not to traumatize the child, all right? But there is this feeling of you, as an authority, are trying to bend me to become someone I'm not. Right? But as the child grows, they discover that what the parent was in fact training them to do was to in fact be an adult and operate according to the principles of adult life. But that transition does feel unnatural. But once you make the transition, then it makes a tremendous amount of sense. It makes a tremendous amount of sense inside, and you tap into a deeper nature. And you become more harmonious with society. You become more harmonious with yourself. And so too, Judaism claims that the Jewish lifestyle is a lifestyle that uniquely, for you as a Jew, and for all others that feel some kind of draw to it, alright, then that lifestyle coordinates you to the symphony of life. It's the particular movement that you play in this symphony. Now there are other, you know, there's the trombone section, and then there's the violin section. There are various sections that in unison are facilitating the music of the master. Alright? And I want to know my part. And I want to play my part. And nobody at all in the symphony feels a certain jealousy. Oh, that violin player. Who does he think he is? Why can't we all be tuba players? Of course, that's so silly. You know, that's so silly that you should in any way expect that we should all be tuba players or we should all be violin players. That would be the end of the music. Okay, that would be the end of the music. But then there is a music and I have to get in touch with it. What is appropriately fitting to me and how I uniquely serve in the expression of this ultimate universal symphony? Okay. And so, basically, what is a mitzvah according to this system? A mitzvah is a behavior which we are told synchronizes ourselves to the principles of life, fulfilling the plan, expressing the goal, and fulfilling the will of God. That's what it's all about. All right? That's what it's all about. A mitzvah literally means to enjoin. The word mitzvah, the word tzav, you find also in a hospital. A tzevet. What's a tzevet? A unit. Tzav is to unify. So what really is the life of mitzvah? It is the path of enjoyment. Which is the path of enjoyment. Right? But to enjoin. To synchronize. To harmonize. Right? To coordinate my life to the theme of life. And specifically how I, in what I play, if I play the Jewish part, if I'm in the Jewish section of this symphony, well, I need to know my part. I need to know how I attune myself to it, how I coordinate, how I synchronize to it. All right? And maybe in the initial stages, as we're tuning up, and that takes a while until we get over that, and we realize that there's greater fulfillment to me as an individual if I play with a band, when I play with a symphony. It's not self-effacing to be part of a symphony, but rather I become even more empowered by being part of this greater symphony. Sure, I could be a solo player, and that feels good for my ego. Move in with the tuba players. You know, like, there, we won't want you there. And if you do, they'll start to hate you. They'll start to hate you. Because they initially, innately feel that by you transgressing the borders of becoming a tuba player, or taking your violin and blowing on it, or blowing into it, you are just undermining not only yourself, but us. We love you over there. That's exactly what they say. We want you over there in the violin section, please. Okay? And please be who you are. And by being who you are, you will serve me, yourself, the master, and we will, by being who we are and being committed to our particular identities within the various sections of the symphony, okay, by doing that, we will create a tremendous harmony. Tremendous harmony. Be wonderful. But just don't cross those borders and give up who you are. So a mitzvah gets me in touch with particularly who I am. This is the role I play. This is the particular part of the music I play. This is my instrument. And I practice it, and I practice it, and I play it, and I play it. Right? I play it. When a person practices enough and they just get so attuned and so connected to the symphony, right? Then that is what's called a tzaddik. A tzaddik is a person who is so completely synchronized with the symphony, so completely interfaced with the conductor. His particular will becomes plugged into the universal will of the conductor, and it becomes just absolutely empowering. Alright? Every time you do a mitzvah, what you're basically doing is making your will into God's will. Coordinating your will with the divine will, and in so doing, plugging into the divine will, you become filled with energy, and not only that, but you get guidance. Okay? That goes beyond the mitzvot, which is an amazing idea. You get a certain inner guidance that you can only tune into through the mitzvot. So when we're talking about listening to that inner voice, how can I trust it? Jesus said the only way you can trust it is if you know how to tune in on your dial. How do you tune into the voice of God? It's on 613 on your dial. That's the point. How do I attune myself, tune into, plug my voice into that ultimate universal voice, and then ultimately become a prophet in so doing? Okay? That's why a prophet has to be the ultimate of ethical, sensitive, moral, right? Following and giving their lives only to be a servant to the higher, right? Have overcome that egotistical need, and at that point a person who is reseller can in fact trust that voice, right? And become really a speaker in a way that they know it's not even their own voice, right? They know it's not even their own voice. So that's the process of slowly attuning and attuning myself, plugging into that divine will, and thereby becoming even more interfaced, harmonious, right? Now a friend of mine who was a conductor, he said that one of the most incredible experience of being a conductor is the point where the entire band so interfaces, becomes such a unit, that he said he would literally think of a roar from the trombone section at that very second it would happen. Alright? It wasn't like, you know, he didn't even have to move his hands and like, you know, but there was a point where the relationship within the symphony was so strong, the souls were so connected, and they were so willing to let him be the leader, that he said that in his mind he would just think, and at that very second they would roar. That's a very powerful experience. And the kind of experience you get that with, well, I don't know if you have this musical experience, in terms of like jazz players, they'll talk about that, when they're jamming. Okay? And each one, there's a kind of thing that starts happening where they just know exactly when to start, when to stop, when to woo. It's unbelievable. And each one begins to feel that we're not simply these separate things. We're all individual, but in some way some greater music that's even beyond ourselves is moving through us. And we've attuned to the music, and music was always there. We just somehow attuned to it to the point where that music doesn't seem new at all. It seems ancient. Okay? And we're just, it's just playing through us. That's the attuning. That's the experience of the tzaddik. That's the experience of the prophet. Okay? Therefore, Rav Kook explains that a tzaddik is a natural person. A righteous person is actually a very natural person. You know, people have all kinds of weird, you know, fantasies of what a tzaddik looks like, a great Torah scholar looks like. I remember I had a big question that I had to ask, and so I was looking for a great halakhic, you know, authority. So I heard of this rabbi, and so I decided to go see him. But of course, how do you get into great people? Generally, in the world that we're in, you make appointments. So I knocked on the door. I felt uncomfortable already that, but I didn't have the phone number. And someone opens the door. I say, could I meet with the rabbi? And could I make an appointment? He said, well, he's here. Maybe he'll see you now. Now? Great people you never see now. All right, fine. So he says, yeah, come on in. So I walk into the room. And I had all kinds of images of what this man would look like. And what do I see? Right, this man lying on a bed on his side, right, in his house coat, whatever, and he's got Gemaras piled up, and he's sitting there writing, you know, I'm sure the most deepest stuff of Torah, and he looks at him and says, hi, who is this guy, you know, could this be the great, you know, then he gets up, puts on his slippers, Shalom Aleichem, he was so natural, he was so real, and that's what happens, the tzaddik becomes so real, so interfaced with the natural movement of life. There's just something so natural about them, not something stiff and weird and rigid, but actually something very flowing, something very spontaneous. And yet it's the halacha that made them so spontaneous. That's the whole point. That they have abided by certain principles. They have plugged into the movement of life. They have plugged into the will of God. And these people you can ask advice for, and we trust their advice. Because we don't feel that their advice is simply their advice. We feel that somehow they're so intuitively, so connected with Hashem, that they can give us some very godly advice. Right? Yes, Elena.
Rambam, for example, says that the ideal of Torah is to eat bread and water and sleep on the floor. That's not a natural thing for people to do.
Actually, that's not exactly true. That's not exactly what he said. The question is, what's the path to get to this? Okay? In other words, there are difficult times for the child from the transition of toilet training to a whole new life, and he has to go through things, okay, in order to prepare himself to that. But the goal of Judaism is to be able, if you're not able to live with bread and water and sleep on the floor, then you will not be able to live the life of luxury, right, without it controlling you. That's really the point, right? Judaism is not anti-luxury. It's anti-luxury controlling your life, right, and being somewhat divorced from the real ultimate theme of life and becoming its own theme in and of itself. Okay, so a mitzvah is an act which is, in a simple sense, referred to as the will of God. All right? The will of God. But more than that, right, it coordinates my life to, so to speak, the universal life, the movement of life, the theme of life. All right? And when a person does this, they reach this incredible mystical experience called feeling groovy. Because that's what it really means. You are in the groove of life. You know, you were in the groove of life. And this is what's called in Kabbalah, mochin de gadlut. Expanded awareness or consciousness, or probably in New Age they would probably call it cosmic consciousness. Whereby you are an individual, but you experience yourself as an instrument for the expression of God in the world. You feel that you're an individual, but somehow everything you do is in service of a greater, and you feel the whole world is part of your personal definition. That violinist experiences the entire symphony within himself, and yet he's a violin player. He doesn't lose his unique individual character, and yet somehow his individual identity is defined by the whole orchestra, the whole symphony. The whole symphony becomes part of himself. So he experiences this symphony as a reality beyond himself, and yet also a reality within himself. Do you follow? The symphony is both transcendent and yet both imminent. Transcendent of his identity, and yet so much within an aspect within his identity. And this is an absolute incredible experience. Alright? And this is basically the metaphor for what the life of mitzvah is really all about. What halacha is really all about. Halacha is a path. It's not laws. It's a path. And when I follow the path of halacha, what I'm basically doing is coordinating my particular path to the higher path. And in so doing, I plug into that higher path. Now I know for some people who are a little versed in Eastern religions, this sounds a little bit like Taoism. So what? Why should that bother me that there are various ideas in the world that are similar? That should only make me happy. Okay? But there is a distinction. Because my understanding, for those people who might not know Taoism, Taoism literally means the way. And Taoism is this understanding that there is a dance to the universe. And you want to coordinate yourself to that in terms of simple things like eating according to the season. Not eating fruits that are out of season, but rather being coordinated, because if that's the fruits that are in season, that's exactly the right fruit for the right time. Like right now, thank God there's watermelon. Watermelon in the winter, you know what I mean? It's not watermelon season winter. You know, this is not the right thing, but in the summer, all the fruits, the kind of fruits and vegetables that accord to the seasons are precisely interfaced with who we are and what we need at this time. What happens with this export-import is we start eating watermelons in the middle of the winter because it came from some other place, and that throws us off the balance and the rhythm of life. And so that's just a simple idea, but there's more than that. And this is the whole idea in Tai Chi and all this stuff. But this was the idea of Judaism all along. But Judaism has a very, very advanced, very detailed music that you can follow to plug into the way. Alright? And specifically for you and the role you play in this symphony. Alright? That's what Judaism claims. In addition, my understanding of Taoism is that the Tao doesn't have a direction. It's like a dance. It moves this way, it moves that way, it moves this way, it moves that way, but it doesn't really have a direction. And that Judaism disagrees with. Because Judaism says that life has a very clear direction. It is a life of becoming more perfect, more improved, identifying more and more with the values of God, identifying more and more with the divine ideals, and drawing those values and drawing those ideals into myself through identification with them, and ultimately coming to a true deep bonding with God. All right? And it's a very clear direction that we're going, coming closer and closer to the divine reality. All right. So there are differences, but the fact that there are certain similar ideas throughout the religions shouldn't disturb us, that should make us happy. It should only confirm that there's something really here, that mankind must seek the way and coordinate their lives to a higher way, that their life isn't simply a solo, okay? We're not just stand-up comedians. We have a cast. There's a director. There's a script. There are particular lights. And we need to know when our exits and our entrances are. Okay? And if we don't know it, we not only throw ourselves off, we throw the whole play off. But the play has a very real theme. Okay? And that's very important to remember. So therefore, tshuva is for returning, getting back to that harmony. And therefore, it says that when a person does tshuva, when they do repentance, they bring healing to the world. Because when a person does a sin, so to speak, it's called sickness in Judaism. Right? Why? Because sin causes disease in the world. Or let's put it this way, dis-ease in the world. Okay? That's really what it's causing. I'm behaving a way that's creating a tension in the universe. I'm putting out dissonance with my life. Okay? And therefore, the Torah says that, in fact, sin is called a machala. That actually it's connected to some unhealthy living. You are spiritually losing your hygiene. Okay? It's spiritually, unhygienic? Is there such a word as unhygienic? Right?
Yeah.
And then there's spiritual hygiene. Everybody knows it. You know, there's certain things. You gotta brush your teeth. Okay? Physical hygiene. And you do it every day. And hopefully you do it meticulously. And if you don't do it, then don't be surprised when the dentist says to you, you've lost your teeth. Because you didn't do what you have to do. Alright? So why do people think that there's something called physical hygiene and there's nothing called spiritual hygiene? Right? Why do people think that the physical body has some very real principles and rules that maintain a healthy harmony between themselves and their environment, and the spirit doesn't? I think that's, you know, and psychology is proving more and more how psychology is very real. Okay? So, and this is just simply unhealthy. And so when a person does a chet, they're doing something simply unhealthy. Something unhealthy. When a person does tshuva, they bring refuah to the world, the Talmud says. And what is refuah? Healing. The word refuah, Hebrew word for healing, rofet, is a healer, comes from the word refui. Right? Refui. Does anyone know what the word refui is? Refui is to be loose and lax. Right? Because what's hinted here is that sickness comes through tension and dissonance, and health comes through harmony. Rav Nachman says an amazing thing. He says, when you're sick, a good cure for it is to dance. What is he talking about? A cure for sickness is dancing. And he points at an interesting kind of relationship in the Hebrew language. The word for sickness is machala, and the word for dance is mecholot. The same word. It's very interesting. There's some kind of connection. Anyways, getting back to the harmony of life, the integration of myself, with my community, finding my role, the section in the symphony, connecting with the conductor, interfacing with the symphony, experiencing that incredible music that goes beyond myself, experiencing my identity, to the inclusion of the entire symphony, this is called Mochim de Gadlut. This is called the expanded mind. Right? The expanded mind. I'm filled with a consciousness, a self-consciousness that includes all, and yet doesn't lose self in that all-inclusive experience of I. Because my I is so interfaced with you and with the eternal you, that you and the eternal you become within. I experience you as part of me, and yet I don't lose my me. Alright? That's very important to know. Right? That's the deeper understanding that Judaism always had. Now, of course, there's some people, when we're growing up and we're children, so we're taught mitzvot are good points. You know, scout points. And that's what it is. Mitzvot, you rack them up, you save them, you cast them in the next world. Okay? And I don't know if I told you, I was dating this woman, and one of the things that's very important to get a sense of who a person is ask them what they envision in their lives, like describe a day in your life. So I said, do you have like a, something which, you know, just give me a day in your life of marriage. And so what she came up with is, she said, well, what comes to my mind, what just gives the symbol of our, you know, our home, when I see a mitzvah chart on the refrigerator door. And whenever the children come in, right, they do a mitzvah. And if they do a mitzvah, they get a star on that chart. And if they collect about 10, 15 mitzvahs, they get a prize. I said, okay, that's nice. And I said, well, what else do you envision in your home? And that was it. I mean, that was like the image of what just comes to her as just a wonderful day in their home. And so she felt my kind of disappointment, I guess. And she said, well, what about you? I said, I don't know. And I think of my home, I just think of light. I just sense a home just full of light. And she said, that could run a high electrical bill. And I was like, she was kind of being a little to me, but like I realized, like, hey, this is not a match, you know. But what I realized is, I mean, this is very nice for kids. There's no question, you know. I would use a mitzvah chart too for children, okay? And that's a metaphor that's important to understand in their process of growth. All right. But there are people that are, you know, in their 20s and their 30s, and they still have this kind of childish sense that mitzvot are these, you know, Boy Scout points, and that God, you know, God, he has this big cosmic refrigerator. And on his refrigerator, he has your chart. But then again, I want you to know, and this is probably making you very nervous, that God has a cosmic oven also. And right in that oven is his transgression chart. So beware of God and his kitchen. Okay? And the world to come is God's kitchen. I mean, you know, okay, we'd never agree. We'd never acknowledge that that's what we think. But if we have nothing else to think about, so what else could we think? We have no other image of Judaism. We haven't grown in our Jewish perceptions. But now we get deeper and deeper. We realize that Talmud says the reward of a mitzvah is the mitzvah. What are you talking about? The reward of playing the music is playing the music. Right?
And on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, when we say that there's a book, what do we mean by that? That Hashem says he's keep records of...
Well, that's a metaphor that's important to encourage you, to inspire you. But what does it mean? What book do you want to be in? You decide which theme you'd like to find yourself in. Because your life defines who you are and what book, so to speak, what theme of life you're playing. And so you would like to be in the book of Tzaddikim rather than the other play that's playing down the street. In other words, you are really writing your lines. You are writing your character, and one character does not fit. And therefore, so to speak, God puts you in another theme. Okay? But these are metaphors to try and encourage you, try to get you to feel something. Okay? But they are metaphors. They are metaphors. And so, and there is a scale. There's no doubt one mitzvah could tip the scale over. All right? That's one way of explaining it. All right? And a very authentic way of explaining it. But they're still metaphors. But then there's another metaphor. As we grow older, you know, so when my child is being toilet trained, then why does he do it? Because I tell him that if you do it in your pants, then you're going to lose this. And if you do it in the pot, you're going to get this teddy bear. Right? So there's this feeling like, oh, okay, fine. Right? But he feels he's doing it for me. And he feels he's kind of doing it for himself, but he doesn't have any sense of the value of the act itself. Now that's part of his transition. That's where he's at. That's the correct educational mode to get him to that next step. But when he gets to the next step, he finds what's gratifying about going to the bathroom is that he is being a fully mature human being, coordinated with life. All right? And so too, as we grow older, we discover that the reward of Shabbos is Shabbos, okay? And if I don't keep Shabbos, right? What frightens me more is the affliction that I'm causing truly to myself, where I'm actually losing the harmony with who I am and what I'm doing in the world and what I could be doing for my family. And that really becomes the ultimate punishment. That becomes the ultimate punishment. And so they say, you know, what's the world to come? What's hell? So they say, you know, there's a cute kind of analogy. Really, a person dies and they find themselves in this theater. So it's very shocked. A theater. And perhaps you've spent much of your life in theater, you know, you're watching movies. You know, wow, this is really interesting. A lot of people are there. And say, wow, what's going on? So you turn to the guy and says, what's showing? He says, it's a double feature. A double feature? Yeah. Well, what's the show? Who's the star? You'll see, right? And on the stage is right away the star, David Aaron. David Aaron, yes. And the first show, the first movie, is How I Lived My Life. And the second movie, the double feature, is How I Could Have Lived My Life. And depending how harmonious these two movies are, will determine the temperature of my popcorn. Got it? Okay? Got it? All right? And so, there's, you know, there's a way to do it, and there's a way not to do it. And there's a way that I'm really harmonizing with myself and what this world is, and there's a way that I'm not harmonizing with myself and not the way the world is. And I gotta be real careful. So Judaism has offered us a gift. It claims that this is the path of coordination. This is the path of harmony. And that really, I kind of view mitzvot as footsteps on the dance floor, okay? And you kind of walk into it and you say, gee, who dirtied up your floor? Look at all these footsteps on your floor. I'm sorry, no, we painted that specifically. Well, what is that? And each foot has a 1, 2, 3, 4, one, you know, and you it just looks rigid, it looks silly, and they just say, follow the steps. Follow the steps. And as you do it, you kind of feel silly, you kind of feel rigid, you kind of feel, but all of a sudden you move and you go and there's so much more between the steps. Okay? Each mitzvah is a step, but there's so much light and harmony between the steps. And therefore, it says mitzvah goreret mitzvah. When a person does one mitzvah, it already leads them into the next mitzvah. Because we don't view mitzvahs as these little separate points, good boy, you know, but rather it's the movement of life. It's the Jewish dance, but not dance in terms of having no theme and not going from point A to point B. But this dance does have a theme, it does have a development. And this tremendous amount of awareness and consciousness in every move I make. But I want to be harmonious with the will of the conductor. Yes?
About the movie theater parable, I was just wondering, what about the idea of having everybody watching? Is that true? Are you feeling embarrassed?
No. I mean, the point is like this, that the world to come isn't a place, nor is this idea of like some kind of hell a place. It's a consciousness. It's the realization that you will have when after this world you will realize what life could have been and what life always really was. And you were either running away from it, denying or pretending it wasn't really there. And when it hits you, that itself is the pain, that itself is the fixing. Okay? That itself is the pain, that itself is the fixing. When you realize that you were so out of whack, what you thought life was all about, what you thought was the theme of life, you thought the theme of life was money. Okay, and therefore you coordinated, you took all the strategy, you planned, you adopted principles and visions which would best succeed in making money, but all of a sudden you're in the next world and you're discovering that the theme of life wasn't money. Although money was an aspect of life, but it was the theme. You see, the problem with people today is they take things that are truly valuable, but make this mistake to think that that's the theme. Rather than maybe one of the words, or maybe one of the paragraphs, or one of the aspects of the theme. But this is really the problem, that we take things that we sense are important, and, you know, career is important, money is important, this is important, yeah, sure, of course, but they're not the theme. And when they become the theme, they destroy your life. When they become an aspect of the theme, okay, then they become very fulfilling. Okay, but we haven't yet talked about what is the theme of this becoming. We're now dealing with the particular activity. And therefore, what we're going to simply do is fill in this chart. And this is really the system of Judaism. The chart over here is halakha. Halakha and mitzvot. What is it? Halakha and mitzvot is a particular lifestyle that coordinates my individual life to a universal life. That's what it is. Goreret, it draws you into another mitzvah. Right? Another mitzvah. You don't have to take on all the mitzvot. Just take on one. Right? Just try and plug in a little bit. And then, you know, and then a little more. And it will just become more natural. And it will become more, and there'll be things. Look it, there's transition here. And there's the difficulties of transition. Right? There are difficulties transition. But Judaism claims that the path of Judaism is not a path of inner suppression. There's some things that I have to suppress in order to get to a higher inner nature. Okay? A plugging into my neshama. And my neshama is plugged into the divine. And so, yes, there are transition points. There's no question about it. You know, there's no question about it. I mentioned to you before that when my wife and I decided to eat healthy, okay, so, you know, it was a process, it was difficult, no white sugar, this and that. And so we were eating healthy. And then once in a while we'd kind of like, sin, okay? And we'd go out, have a pizza and a Coke, and all of a sudden we'd be, oh, we're so sick! You know, we have tremendous physical reactions to it. And so this didn't make any sense to me, so I called the guy that was counseling us, you know, in our diet. I said, listen, this doesn't make any sense. You see, before, when we ate junk food, we were fine. We're absolutely fine. I can eat anything and feel fine with it. Now that I'm eating healthier, I eat, you know, I have a candy, or I have a this, or I react. He says, that's a sign of getting healthy. He says, if you eat junk food and your body doesn't react, that's a bad sign. That means that your body is sick. Okay? Because a healthy body reacts. Okay? As you become healthier, you become more sensitive. And you become more attuned. And it's amazing when you eat healthier, you lose. You lose your desire for junk food. So you just don't have an interest for it. It's a weird thing. You know, you do it because everyone else is doing it because they're saying, Coke, Coke, Coke. So how can I not? It's life. But and of course it's a real thing on top of that. So, you know, so we do it. But, so as we're going through the process of health, we'll go through a lot of sickness. But the sickness is getting something out. You know, getting something out. It's a process of healing. In the process of healing, you go through sickness. When a person is doing tshuva, they can expect some difficulties. They might even feel physically sick because they're actually getting in harmony with things. Right? Getting in harmony with things. And so, I don't know, I mentioned this to a couple people. I went to a dentist. He looks at my tooth. He says, you know, you need root canal. I said, I need root canal? What are you talking about? Nothing's wrong with my tooth. He said, well, did it hurt you ever? I said, oh yes, a month ago, but it's gone now. He said, yes, of course, because it's dead. Right? He says, as long as it hurts, it's alive. Once it stops hurting, it's dead. And so too, you know, once we stop hurting and we stop feeling the pain, that's not necessarily a good sign. That could mean that we've hit rock bottom. You know, we've hit rock bottom. We're not reacting in a healthy way. You know, in a healthy way. And so the path of the mitzvot is coordinating myself to that universal life. Okay. Now the truth is that this whole system, this whole idea, is actually becoming a scientific principle. And I taught this class, and somebody said, gee, a friend of mine sent me some Xerox pages of a book, and it's amazing the stuff in this book really coordinates with what you're talking about. So they showed me these pages, but unfortunately a couple of the pages were missing, so it wasn't coherent at all. Okay, so I couldn't really understand what it was. And then I walked into a used bookstore a couple days later, and I see this book, okay? And I pick up this book, just flipping through it, and something about it seems familiar. And I realized that this was actually the book that this person gave me. All right? So God does guide us to what we need to see sometimes, if we're open to see it, which is barely we are. Okay? And so this is a book called The Silent Pulse by a guy named George Leonard. And interestingly enough, like a lot of these New Age books, he never says the word God. God forbid. Right? You know, so he's got all kinds of highfalutin ways of saying the same thing that we're all being saying. But anyways, this is very fascinating. In 1665, a Dutch scientist by the name of Christian Huygens noticed that two pendulum clocks mounted side by side on a wall would swing together in precise rhythm. Okay, so you got two pendulum clocks on a wall. And they're going, you know, and they're swinging back and forth in absolute, you know, synchronization. Now, he wondered why. Why are they synchronized like that? So he thought maybe it has something to do with the wall. They would hold their mutual beat, in fact, far beyond their capacity to be matched in mechanical accuracy. Okay? Mechanical accuracy. What the science, well, what they tried to thought, they thought maybe something's going on in the wall, vibrations through the wall, but what they discovered is what scientists were to call later on mutual phase locking of two oscillators. And what they call it simply entrainment. Okay, this is what it's called, entrainment. Now this phenomenon, as it turns out, is universal. Whenever two or more oscillators in the same field are pulsing at nearly the same pulse, they tend to lock in and pulse in exact harmony. All right. The example of this is the old television sets. I don't know if you had an old television and you're sitting there watching I Love Lucy. Anybody watch I Love Lucy? Okay, and all of a sudden Ricky Ricardo's face goes, and then you got, oh no, what the hell, a picture, what am I going to do? And so you got to do the vertical and the horizontal knobs, and you're trying it, and you get this frustrating experience, but all of a sudden, boom, you get Ricky Ricardo. Okay? Right? And so it wasn't the slow, eventual, you know, it's focusing in. It was actually sudden. Right? You're just like, no, all right, bink. Right? What happened? Well, you don't have to tune your television completely to the frequency of the broadcasting station, but you have to come close, and at that point, it just gets sucked in. You understand? It just locks with it, naturally. Fascinating phenomenon. Well, this is what they're seeing more and more. Living things are like television sets, because they watch them all day long, okay, in that they contain oscillators. In fact, we might say that living things are oscillators. We all have our certain frequency. Right? We all have our inner frequency, our inner rhythm. And in fact, we might say that things are oscillating. That is, they pulse or change rhythmically. So there's a certain rhythm to our bodies. You know, he talks about how autistic children are people who have somehow lost their rhythm, and people are working through music to get in touch with the natural inner rhythm. All right. The simplest celled organism oscillates to a number of different frequencies at the atomic level, molecular, subcellular, cellular level. Microscopic movies of these organisms are striking for ceaseless rhythmic pulsation that is revealed. Now they've got this movie, a microscopic movie, all right, called The Incredible Machine. And what this is a view of two individual muscle cells from the heart. You see them through the microscope, and they're pulsing at separate rhythms, right? Separate rhythms, okay? Then they move closer. You see these cells moving closer, and even before they touch, there's a sudden shift in rhythm, and they pulse perfectly, synchronized. This is what they say.
Just put it in, like,
I have no idea. I just read these books. Okay, I have no idea. But it was a movie, and you can actually literally see them all of a sudden, boom! You know, lock! And so, this is what he says. Just as our internal rhythms are locked on hold, you see, our whole body has a rhythmic relationship of harmony. Our whole body is musical. Okay? That's probably why music is such an important thing for our lives, and some music is bad for us, actually, because it's not healthy for our holy rhythm. Anyways, what happens is, they're entrained, just as our internal rhythms are locked and held with each other, they also entrained with the outside world. Our physical and mental states change in rhythm with the seasonal swing of the earth and the sun, with the tides, with the day-night cycle, and perhaps even with cosmic rhythms that present-day scientists hasn't yet isolated and defined. So there's this entrainment, there's this harmony that must occur between myself and the external world, with the sun and the moon, the day and the night. What he just described was Judaism, right? Certain prayers in the day, certain prayers at night, certain mitzvot that are just for this season. Okay? And it's interesting to note that all the holidays coordinate to the zodiac. Completely. Okay? So, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur come out during the month of Libra. It's the scales. Alright? They're all connected. The holiday of Passover, Aries. Passover is all about independence. Aries is all about independence. Okay? They're all connected. And therefore the holidays and their laws enable us to rhythmically harmonize with the movement of the world. And he says, well, maybe there's these cosmic rhythms, right? Rather than say God's will, call it cosmic rhythms, that present-day science hasn't yet isolated and defined. When these rhythms are forced out of phase, disease is likely. Dis-ease is inevitable. Okay? Dis-ease is inevitable because I'm not harmonious. So there's a guy named Dr. William Condon from Boston University School of Medicine. And this guy has been working on what he calls the unseen conversational dance. Okay? Now what he does is he took a movie of a person speaking to somebody. Alright? And he did what he calls microanalysis, which is he viewed it at slow motion every fraction of a second. Alright? Now what this guy did is he proved that what's really happening between a listener and a speaker is there's really a rhythmic dance going on. And that if he were to take a movie of us right now, okay, he could prove that everybody's body movement is completely rhythmically interfacing with every syllable I say. Isn't that amazing? Okay? Now I experienced that as a teacher. Okay? I experienced that as a teacher. Because something's going on. It's not like I'm standing up here and I'm talking, you know, and you're listening. Okay? But a person who's reading a book while I'm speaking actually throws me off. Okay? Completely throws me off. Because there's really something rhythmically happening. Another person writing, okay? People passing notes. They think I don't see it. I don't even have to see it. It throws me off. Okay? And I can say that was a horrible class. I've done it a million times better, but it's not really completely my fault. It's just the energies in the group. It's the openness. It's the rhythm. And so there's actually something happening all the time. There's a rhythm going on. And if we get to that rhythm, it happens. Okay? It happens. And I just become a speaker. And I don't even sometimes, you know, it's just coming down. And something inside me tells me what to say next. Okay? Right? Something inside me tells me what to say next. And I have to always learn to just follow that. I have to learn to follow that. And there's, you know, I've done this class so many different times. So right now, in fact, this class, I did it completely different than I've ever done before. Okay? And I was actually struggling while I'm talking right now. Because something inside me said, no, go in this direction. Right? Just keep going in that direction. And I just have to trust that. And I just keep going in that direction. All right? But that's what's going on between us. And we just kind of think that all that's going on in life is what we see. Most of what's going on in life you don't see. Okay? Not with your physical eyes anyways. So this is what he says. Rhythm or time must be seen, Condon explains, as a fundamental aspect of organization of behavior, not as something added to it. It's fundamental. All right. Now listen to what he says. This is amazing. Condon's film studies show that a normal newborn infant, like a normal adult, moves synchronously with the pattern of the mother's voice. So the baby somehow has a rhythmic connection with the mother's voice. And this is what he says. He said it doesn't matter if it's English, Chinese, Swahili. It's becoming clear and clear through studies that there's some kind of literal content is only a part, probably a minor part, of human communication. Okay, the literal what I'm saying is much less part of the communication than the rhythm that we have to achieve. And another person could take all this content and still wouldn't communicate it. Okay, because that's a minor part of the content. There's a rhythm that has to be achieved. And listen to what he says. He says, the infant is born already connected with the fundamental rhythms that hold us all together. Fascinating. Hold us all together. I see the world altogether unified. The brain of the baby is also unified, interfaced with an ongoing rhythmic unity that represents its world. Infants are born with the order of the world already in them. He just said the Midrash. The Midrash says that when I was born, my soul knows the entire Torah. And what is the Torah? It is the order of the world. Okay? It's the order of the world that's within me already. Very fascinating stuff. There's all kinds of other experiments that they did in terms of language. So there's a guy named Stetson. And this is what he says. A culture may be said to have a language, but a culture is a rhythm. So he talks about how it's difficult to get a language. In other words, you could learn Hebrew, but the difficulty is getting the rhythm of Hebrew. Not just simply the words. Ani, slicha, ani me Toronto. Right? Well, you're using English rhythm to the Hebrew language, and it doesn't work. He says, the fact is every ethnic group has got rhythm, but the rhythms are different from one another. And so there's a Jewish rhythm, and there's this rhythm. Everyone's got a different rhythm. A guy named Dr. Byers from Columbia University, who's done experiments in researching nonverbal communication with the Marings of New Guinea, the Eskimos, the Kung Bushmen, he's found this rhythm. All right. And now listen to what this fellow Byers says. Byer points out that a variety of bodily processes can become synchronized through close interaction. Singing, rowing, and sometimes marching will synchronize breathing. Synchronized heartbeats have been reported between psychiatrists and patients. Female college roommates sometimes find their menstrual cycles synchronized. Okay, well, what's going on? Okay, what's going on? It is the basic character of life. The more you move in rhythm with someone, Dr. Condon told me, the closer you become with that person. And so too, the more I tap into the rhythm of the Jewish life, right? The Jewish rhythm, the mitzvah rhythm, the more I come closer to who I am and the divine, so Judaism claims. Very fascinating piece over here. He talks about his own experience as a teacher, as a lecturer, which I completely understand. But in both there is entrainment between, he talks about jazz musicians, but both there is entrainment between sound and gesture between participants. And if you are willing to entertain such an idea, there is entrainment between the self and cosmos. We call the all-encompassing one reality, God. And if the culture should attempt to break the expression of this rhythm of relationship between the self and the cosmos, and I would say between the self and the all-encompassing one reality, the divine, it is the culture that eventually must yield. And this is the secret of Jewish survival. That the Jewish people, even if they don't practice the mitzvot, there's still a certain connectedness that they've gained through their ancestors who have. Alright? Anyways. That's what, in a deeper sense, mitzvot are all about. Okay? Halacha is all about. So there's a midrash that says that a person who studies halacha every day becomes a child of the world to come. And it learns it from a verse that says, to God are the processes of the world. Halichot olam. The processes of the world. Okay? So the rabbis say, don't read processes, but it's a play on word they make. Read halachot. The laws of the world. In other words, Judaism claims that there is a path to life, there is a movement to life, there is a theme to life, okay? And I have the opportunity as an individual to choose to synchronize with it or to go in dissonance with it, okay? And that's really my choice in life.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.